Welcome to Yoga Perspectives, a podcast from Heartwood Yoga Institute that helps yoga teachers and practitioners gain clarity in yoga principles and practices. Join us for down-to-earth conversations that make sense of classical and contemporary yoga concepts to deepen your understanding while keeping you connected, inspired, and awakened to yoga's full potential. And now, your host, Ginny Shattuck.
Welcome to Yoga Perspectives. My name is Ginny Shattuck, and I'm the owner and the philosophy teacher at Heartwood Yoga Institute. And today we're going to talk about how to learn the Yoga Sutras. I think the most important question we should start off with is, who am I to teach the Yoga Sutras? I'm just this redheaded, freckle-faced, all-American, 63-year-old woman, and I'm not a Indian guru. So do I have anything to say of merit? Is it worthy? Am I worthy of your audience? So I am just a yoga teacher with a sincere interest of learning and understanding the practice I love. I am the philosophy teacher because this has been the course I've been on for many, many years in my sincere desire to understand and interpret the sutras. I've taken courses with Sanskrit scholars, and I've listened to YouTube lectures with famous gurus, as many of us have. I've taken formal courses with teachers at places like the Shivananda Center. I've done online tons of sutra courses during the pandemic, as many of us who were stuck at home thought this is a great time to reach out. And suddenly, many, many courses were available online that were not available previously. I've also taken academic courses with college professors and courses like the great courses that, you know, produces the great text and things that allow us to see the academic view. I've enjoyed courses with teachers like Doug Keller, who does a history and philosophy course that you can listen to in Yoga International, and it was phenomenal. I would recommend it to anybody. And most importantly, I have read a tremendous amount of books. I have read different interpretations. This has helped to expand my understanding. But the most important thing I've done that makes me really have a deeper understanding of the Yoga Sutras is that I teach them. And when I sit in community and I'm holding Sangha and I'm talking to others, questions come up all the time. And I have to seek deep within to come up with those answers and contemplate and really consider what is the most appropriate interpretation for one person or one group of people, and how can I help them to have a deeper understanding. To teach is to learn, and I think that the most prominent and important way to learn the Yoga Sutras is to sit with them and to make it a very personal journey, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So many of the different types of courses I've taken, they range in both the approach and the effectiveness. And Sanskrit scholars and the gurus and the books and the interpretations and the personal reflection and application are all different pathways we can take to learn. And frankly, I think something is given to us for each of those things. There is no one pathway or one easy way to really understand the sutras. I think all of us should branch out and try to understand things experientially, academically, intellectually, and devotionally. So each of these different types of teachers touches a different level of understanding within us. So how were the Yoga Sutras originally taught? Pretty much people would, life was divided into four major energetic portions. And in the time of Brahmacharya, young men would go into the forest for 14 years to study. And they would work with a guru. And this would be a period of abstinence where they're not going to engage in society and worldly things. And they were devoting their heart and soul to the spiritual path. And these sutras that were 196, sutras were provided over a course of 14 years. And I always kind of kid my students, and I think, and now we can do it in 200 hours, 300 hours. You can do it all remotely online, which kind of shows that in today's society, we quite are missing some of the devotional quality or the ability to really give ourselves over to these teachings fully as they were originally taught. So they would go into the forest for 14 years. And during that period of time working with the guru, they would be given one of the teachings, such as yoga chitta vritta niradaha, you know, modifications of the mind, that is yoga. And then they would go off and they would contemplate and meditate and then converse about it and come back and go forth and apply it and look into nature for evidence that this is truth and real before they move on to the next one. So what happens today is we think that it's a matter of memorizing these sutras and grasping a surface understanding, and we're ready to move on. In other words, okay, I already have the sutras down. Now I want to learn all about sound healing, and then I'm going to pop in and learn some restorative poses, and aren't I a great yoga teacher because I have all this information in my head. And what yoga kind of teaches us is it is not the information in your head that you can count on, but there is a heart knowing. And I've talked about that in podcasts before, and we'll address it again in this one. So I once went to a convention not very long ago, and there were some people doing some spiritual teaching. And I go to these courses just to validate what I know and how I'm teaching it, and to see if there might be a better way that someone else teaches the same concepts. So I go to the course, and it was really a lovely and wonderful course. The teacher did a good job. And at the end, it was a yoga therapy convention. And at the end, a teacher stood up and said, you know, the problem with this organization and the problem with yoga education today is that nobody's teaching this stuff. Absolutely nobody. And that didn't sit real well with me. And I, you know, kind of raised my hands and I said, well, actually, schools are supposed to be teaching this. And if you are, you know, actually trying to, you know, meet the agreement that we make when we are either Yoga Alliance certified or IAYT certified, basically, these are part of the competencies. And everyone should be teaching these, whether they do or not. That's, you know, a personal thing. And that means you should work very hard to find a good place to study with if these are things that you want to know. And the teacher of this course looked at me and she goes, do you teach these things? And I said, I absolutely do. And she said, yes, but not really. And I thought, I was kind of taken back. I thought, what do you mean, not really? And she said, all you do is teach academically on the surface, and that's not really knowing them. Now, I took a little exception to this because I thought, well, you don't know how I teach these things. And, you know, it's my defensiveness rising to the surface. And I didn't say anything because it was not relevant nor important. And I didn't want my ego to be what was interceding this exchange, or it really wasn't important. I didn't need to defend what I do. But I thought it was very interesting that it was already assumed that because I'm a Western teacher, that I am not teaching this correctly because I'm just making people academically understand it. And by the way, the person teaching the course was also a Westerner. And so, you know, I kind of sat back and I thought, no, I don't teach it that way. And I'll be sharing with you today how I do teach it so that you may teach others or use some of these ideas in your own path. So the purpose of this podcast is not to toot my own horn of how I teach things, but I have been doing this for a lot of years. So I would like to share some of the things I do that have made me develop a deeper understanding and that has been able to reach a lot of students. And I think that that's really important for all of us as yoga teachers to consider. So one of the things that the Yoga Sutras do teach us is, how does the mind work? What are the obstacles to our spirituality? And what does get in the way? And a heart knowing is what we're striving for. And that cannot be done with memorization. Often people will sit down, beginners especially, and they want to learn like the yamas and niyamas. And pretty soon they're like, ahimsa means do no harm, check. And now I'm moving on to satya means honesty, check. And asteya means non-stealing, check. Oh, look, I'm just checking off my list. I know what all these things mean. But they're not really applying them to their lives. And they're not really sitting with them to find the deeper understanding or the personal interpretation of these things. And they tend to get a little sketchy with even how they apply them to their lives. In other words, yes, I absolutely practice non-harm. I'm a vegan. I don't eat meat. But they also look in the mirror and have derogatory thoughts going through their head about their imperfections, which is harmful. And so it's almost like we are blind to how we actually do harm, because we pick and choose in a surface way what these sutras mean. So I've talked before about the heart knowing in my early podcast. I don't want to repeat myself, but you may want to go back and listen to some of those early posts that we've done. And in that, I also talk about marga, or the path. So marga is this concept that in order to teach anything, we must fully experience it. It cannot be an intellectual or, you know, academic knowledge. If I wanted to go to Publix and someone said to me, hey, Ginny, can you take me to Publix? And I know there's a Publix about 5 miles from where I live. And I can say, yeah, it's over on the right. It's on the corner of, you know, Main Street and Smith Street. And you can just get down there, go to the right, and then turn left, and you'll make it there. And I've driven by, and I know about this Publix because everyone knows it's there. And I feel pretty confident in telling them how to get there. However, if I personally have gone to Publix hundreds and hundreds of times, I have probably met some obstacles along the way. Perhaps one day there was a torrential rain and we had flooding. And I was like, oh, well, you can't take this street because you'll hit the flood if it's raining. And you can't go this way because sometimes they're doing construction. And when they do that, they close it off, in which case there's a back way. And I know how to get there because one day they had that construction before. Or there was a car accident once that blocked this entrance. So if you go all the way around, it's a little bit longer, but you can make it there to Publix. And if we had a electrical failure and a blackout in the city and it's no moon today and it's perfectly dark out, I can be like, I can still get you to Publix. I've been there so often that if you walk a certain amount of you know, steps this way, then turn to the right, cut through the backyard of this guy, and then you can make it over, because this has happened too. Oh, but watch out, because there's a mean dog in that one house and that guy might, you know, come after you. I've had that experience as well. I could blindfolded, under any circumstance, take someone to Publix if I have been there 1,000 times, because I'm likely to have had all these different types of experiences, and therefore I have experience and wisdom to share on all the ways to get to Publix. Now, if I just kind of hearsay it, because I kind of know where it is, maybe that person will get to Publix, but they might hit these obstacles, in which case my directions were useless. And yoga is a little bit like this. It is said if we do not do the practices every day and apply them and really decide to sink in deeper over and over and over, how could we be fit to teach others? We certainly aren't fit to teach others, because while I might know what something's about, if I personally don't practice meditation, I don't know what it will be like for that student when they get bored and want to fall off the path, when their anger or their grief is so strong emotionally that they can't concentrate to be able to get the effects of this practice. I don't know how, you know, people fall off the bandwagon of rolling out the mat and doing their yoga practice because people came to visit and then I had problems at work. And next thing I know, I just haven't been doing yoga for a long time and they too fall out of the discipline of it. So if I do this daily, including when I'm bored, when I'm grieving, when work is a struggle for me, if I meet these challenges because I am devoted to the practices, I am fit to teach others because I understand that staying with it isn't easy and that sometimes we have all kinds of obstacles and they're not insurmountable because I myself have approached them and gone past them. And the same thing applies to the Yoga Sutras. The Yoga Sutras are not something we can cherry pick and just decide sometimes I'm going to adhere to this one, other times I don't. I believe in love and forgiveness. Oh, except if it's my ex, because I mean, he doesn't deserve it. I mean, come on, after what he did to me. And so what happens is we decide to be selectively yogic. And sometimes there's this attitude, you know, business is business. So in this case, I'm allowed to behave differently than I might behave in a loving circumstance in a relationship. And there is a sutra that says these teachings are absolute. They cannot be cherry-picked. So one of the first things with understanding the Yoga Sutras is to live them. And how do we actually do that? And that means to know them, or the heart knowing. So there are default setting, the thing we go to first. And we'll get to how to get that in a few minutes. So there are many, many concepts in the Yoga Sutras, if you study all of them, that will help you to understand how or why the sutras are advocating for us to have this heart knowing. And part of it is things like, from the very beginning, the very first sutra says, now the exposition of yoga will begin. What does that mean? Basically, do not walk into the room with what you learned yesterday or what you think you know. Do not be in the future thinking, how am I going to package this and sell it? Or am I even going to use this? What's the point? And people come with into a teaching situation or into a room definitely with preconceived ideas of what they think they know, what they think they want to know. And now the exposition of yoga says we must come as a blank slate in this moment, fully present, to listen, to absorb, and later we can process and decide how it's going to rest within us. This openness is one of the great skills of a great student and a great learner, and therefore a great teacher, someone who isn't filled with arrogance about their own knowledge. That said, the next sutra is this idea that modifications of the mind is what yoga is. And that teaches us also that we have to turn over our mind. There's something more than just the intellect. We move from here to you are the true seer. And so what does that mean? It means, and we'll get to this when we talk about gurus, that within you is where true knowledge resides. And when you study the yugas, which is these periods of humanity and how karma brings us back into being over eons, it talks about how we might be in a more commercial age or a darker age or a more enlightened age. And all of this kind of points to the idea that we have something within us. We are either born with ultimate intelligence, or we are thrust into a society where there will be more of the cliches, more of obstacles for us to have a deeper understanding. And that all talks about how, therefore, we can't really trust our society's teaching or what other people are telling us. Basically, ultimate wisdom is within you. It's right where God resides within us. The Yoga Sutras also go on to talk about our non-attachment to identity and how we can't decide that we are this personification of a person that we are, which is really important when we are looking at other gurus who are nothing but people. And of course, their interpretation is going to be highly adjusted according to their views of life and what they know. Yoga goes on to tell us that how we experience reality through memory or association to words or sleep or ignorance or discernment, all of these things are showing us that what we think we know and see is not really something we can count on. But within us is an instinctual knowing. There is a definite truth that resides, and by going inward, we can find that truth. So I can externalize my studies as much as I want and read books and listen to gurus and be very impressed because the gurus know so much more than I do, of course, that I am, again, externalizing the spiritual journey rather than internalizing it where true wisdom and compassion reside. So the Yoga Sutras also have a lot to say about gurus if you study the full course of them. And one of the things in, 126 says that a teacher or guru is absolutely necessary to learn the gurus, to learn the sutras. And what this means is somebody who has more insight, somebody who has already walked the path, such as saying someone who's already gone to Publix and come back, is necessary for you to start this process, this internalizing and understanding the sutras. So by no means am I advocating that we don't need teachers. But the sutras also go on to say, you can't trust your teachers. Yes, you need one. And every teacher you have should have had a good teacher before them, because that allows us to have a lineage of teachers going back and back and back till we get to classical, you know, times. And when we were closer to the origin of these teachings in their most official and, you know, birth of ideology. And so this idea that we must have a guru but don't trust them fully, because in every case, a guru is dealing with their humanity, which includes ego, and it includes their own interpretation, sometimes their own agenda, which is, I want people to admire me or pay me or whatever conscious or unconscious agenda that might be, you know, ego might be working with them. There's a lot to be said about gurus and trust, and I'll save that for another podcast. But for here, this idea that what is the ultimate guru when we go back through all these lineages, and the ultimate guru from the sutras is said to be God or consciousness or nature, however you want to define that spiritual energy. And that is the ultimate guru, the one to listen to. And all the gurus that have come since are just a part of the ongoing thread of carrying this information forward. But since we are also taught that God resides within us, and that deep down, if you go through the Koshic level from our physical to the pranic level to the mental Manamaya Kosha into the Vijamaya Kosha or instinctual and then to the bliss body, we know that by going inward, we access that ultimate truth. I can't get it from a guru, but a guru can lead the way, and then I must walk the path myself for true understanding. So now we learn the only guru you can trust is your own instinctual understanding and interpretation. You know, a great little documentary, you can find it on Netflix, I believe, still, is Kumare. And it's a funny little documentary about a guy who decided to show himself to be a guru to others. He just made up practices just to see how gullible people were. But in the end, he was teaching them to go inward and trust their own instincts instead of him. So it was actually a wonderful yoga movie, because he's capturing the essence of what a true teacher is by showing he was a false prophet. And I really recommend everybody watch that and give some thought to what you believe, you know, is the deeper message of that particular film. So, instinct, being a part of heart knowing, means how do I awaken my own instinct? And this is where I'm going to bring us to how we might want to learn the Yoga Sutras today. Originally, people would say they would go into the forest for that 14 years. They would talk to the guru, and the guru would say, okay, here's the teaching. And then they would go off and meditate and contemplate and discuss, and then follow that with more meditation and contemplation until they had a true understanding. They would observe nature, find evidence all around them of the truth of this teaching. So today, I think that it would be, you know, fair to say, if I had a student, I'd say, okay, here's the teaching. I have a beautiful garden in my center, and I can say, go out to the chakra garden and sit and contemplate, and I'll see you again tomorrow, and we'll learn some more. And it is likely that my student would go out there and give it a best shot. They would sit quietly, maybe meditate, maybe an hour. And then they'd be thinking, oh, I wonder if I have any messages on Facebook. And then they would kind of be distracted by the birds. And next thing you know, they'd be thinking, I'm sure hungry. And I paid an awful lot of money for this training, and I can't believe she wants me to sit in this garden all day. I mean, when is she going to teach me something? And there would probably be a breakdown of the system. And this is no commentary that students today can't take it or aren't devoted, but culturally, we are in a place where we're moving at great paces, and we have an attachment to this idea that we have to be doing all the time, and we want measurable results for our studies and our work. And so there's quite a few factors that join in together to make it impossible for someone to just sit and contemplate endlessly for 14 years, sutras, in the hopes that this will make them have spiritual growth. Unless, of course, someone has given their life over to this and they're living in a monastery. And of course, there are circumstances where people can and do that. So how do we take today, the average person, especially a Westerner, and say, now you need to sit until you have a heart knowing with these sutras? And the way I have found teaching them works for both myself and for others is to have a crossover of different modalities that I use to keep me fully present with the teachings. So one of the things I do with my 200s is I give them journaling exercises for each of the yamas and niyamas. And so we start with an intellectual lecture that talks about the classical version of what these sutras mean, what these yamas and niyamas mean. And then I open up a discussion and I ask them to look for signs of those different yamas and niyamas, those teachings in their own life. And I say, for example, in what ways do you steal? And this is never to make people feel guilty. It's not a confessional, but it's an opening of awareness. Oh, yes, I am often late and I steal time. I think sometimes I steal my children's opportunities to learn lessons for themselves because I'm quick to rescue them. I think I steal someone's voice when I interrupt them. And in these conversations, we start to open up an understanding of what maybe this teaching embodies. After that, I give them journaling exercises so they can contemplate this concept now in their own life. And in writing, you have a dialogue with yourself. And the dialogue with myself says, oh, this is, you know, like the two birds that are both consciousness and this deeper citta awareness. And I can say, gee, I do steal this way. How does it, you know, impact my life? How is it impacting others? Am I an instrument of healing and light that I want to be, or am I actually creating damage and hardship for others because of my own ego or, you know, smaller needs? And when we get through this journaling process, we start to have a deeper understanding. And then we return to the table for perhaps another teaching and we start to integrate this. So how does non-stealing also affect us in ahimsa? How does it affect us in purity, purification of speech or mind or thought? And as we integrate the different teachings, we come up with a much deeper understanding. What is ahimsa, or what is non-stealing, asteya? It's not about what does asteya mean. It means, it's really, what does asteya mean to me? This is what's important, because it is my interpretation that creates reality, not what somebody else wrote in a book, not what someone told me. Often I will sit with my students and I begin the whole philosophy portion of our training programs, and it's quite extensive in like my 300. And one day I was sitting with some people and I said, you know, the truth is I cannot teach you these sutras. I will academically explain them, but I can't teach them. You have to teach them to yourself. And a woman looked at me and she goes, well, if you can't teach them, why did I pay you all this money? And she was kind of, you know, all put out that I wouldn't just on a silver platter hand her the meaning. And this, again, is wanting a measurable outcome for the fact that she invested in a course and she invested her time to sit there in that little circle around my altar to have a conversation. And my feelings are, well, what you're investing in is time and leadership and opportunity, but the real work I cannot do for you. No one can do it for our students. We are the guru that leads the way, but the guru within them is the one that takes them the full distance. So another thing I do, besides encouraging meditation and contemplation, and perhaps journaling, and definitely the application to my own life, because again, the sutras are not a bunch of rules that we must follow the rules or we're going to go to yoga purgatory. It's really a way of saying the study of these sutras expands my awareness. And when my awareness expands, I see life more honestly. And then I decide, what kind of person do I want to be? And I really want to live and walk a spiritual path. And with greater awareness, I can no longer continue the behaviors which I felt were harmful or that were stealing from others. I see things for what they are, and suddenly it's very distasteful to go through some of the behaviors in our society which are, you know, hurting ourselves and others. So another thing I like to do with my students, when it gets to my more advanced students, I have them do a yoga art journal. And this is a big project I do in my 300-hour programs. And I provide them a big art journaling book and all kinds of art materials. Of course, some people are resistant because they don't feel like they're artistic. But it's not an art project. This is a contemplation project. And if you know anything about art journaling, the first thing you do is you paint a substance on each page, which allows it to be like a canvas. And the second stage is where we put color on the page just as a foundation. And then on top of that, I give people stencils, and they stencil mandalas and om symbols and all kinds of, you know, beautiful artistic things, lotuses and just random designs. And now we have what looks almost like a beautiful wallpaper or, you know, exquisite design. And then on top of that, we have magic markers and things like this. And I'll say, now let's start putting imagery. And that can be through stencils or through magazines, or it can be free hand drawn. It can be something people pull up out of nature, like leaf prints or anything else. And we start building on the page. And when that is dry, we come back and maybe put the Sanskrit on the page and maybe write words which reflect the meaning of the sutra. And you wait for that to dry, and you come back later and you're like, okay, now I think I need to add a flap over here, and I'm going to put a little more description inside, a little more decoration on the outside. Maybe I'll put the Sanskrit version on as well as the American Sanskrit words so I can read them and learn them. And we just keep building on the page and building on the page. You cannot do one of the sutras in one visit in your art journal. Usually you go back to the page about 20 times. And every time they go back to that page, they look back into the interpretation that they had or the notes that they took in their personal journaling. And they go, what does it mean again? Oh my goodness. This one is about how one of the ways our mind works is through sleep. Or let's say this particular one is about how the seeds can rebloom of samskaras. And how do I want to interpret that? Maybe I'll put plants on the page. Maybe I'll put little seeds, you know, a picture of that. Maybe I will interpret that with something else that is a representation of something growing or reemerging that was sleep. You know, asleep before. And having to revisit what it means and having to struggle to find a way, your own interpretation of that particular teaching means I'm sitting with it. Maybe I can't just sit in the garden for 8 hours, but you can bet if you give me some creative outlet, I can actually sit with a teaching for 8 hours if I see something emerging and evolving in front of me that's, you know, very beautiful and fun. I mean, yes, it's entertaining. And I don't mean in a superficial, oh, we have to be entertained way, but I do want to keep myself present and focused on the sutra. And my mind wanders away if I don't have something to channel and keep engaged, fully engaged or absorbed in this one idea or concept. When students are done with their art journal, later they have this beautiful book to revisit, which other people will look at. They go back and go through their journals, and that sparks the memory or a reminder of those teachings once again. It can even be put on an altar for other students to see when they are teachers themselves going through it. I did my entire art journal. It took about 2 years to finish the first version. And then I took another guru's interpretation and I went through it again. And I added to every page some different thoughts or approaches to each of these teachings from a different guru. And of course, it's not the guru's, you know, ideology that's on the page. It is my own. And I come to my understanding because I've listened not to one teacher who told me what it was and memorized it, but because I listened to this teacher, and then I listened to another teacher, and then I listened to an academic course in a college, and then I, you know, sat in my own contemplation, and I wrote about it, and I thought about how this teaching is reflective in all the experiences I've had in this lifetime. And now when I come to the page, I have what I would call the heart knowing. I have a real understanding of what this sutra means to me. Not that it can be tested somewhere or measured, or that another person can come forward and say, oh no, Ginny, you got it wrong. That's not what it means. Because you can't get it wrong. It is really your interpretation. Who is to say that somebody else's, you know, experience defines reality more than your own? You have to have a trust in the greatest teacher of all, and that is experience and your life and your own ability to process and understand information. So how do we learn the Yoga Sutras? First of all, we have to start with a good teacher and being a seeker ourselves. This means spreading out all the different modalities of learning that we have access to. We can do this by watching YouTube videos because it affords us this incredible technology to work with teachers that would be obscurely living on the other side of the planet, perhaps. And suddenly it's like they're there in front of me. Perhaps there's a local teacher you trust that's wonderful, and there are some fabulous academic courses that you might want to take. Oxford Center for Hindu Studies is another place that I study, and I've learned a lot of wonderful things from them. But in every case, I don't think, oh, this is the teacher, now I've got it. It's just one more resource to say, well, here's some more information as I collect different information and I can sit with this and process. The next step from these different modalities is to not have a time frame, not to say, I'm just going to learn this. I went from Sutra 1 to Sutra 195 or 6, depends on who your teacher is, and say, and now I'm done. Because there is no done. I didn't learn them. It is just an ongoing process that will deepen and deepen and deepen the longer I stay with it. Find a way to apply the sutras to your own life in a way that is sincere in contemplation. Meaning, I don't just think, oh, that person said something mean to me and they don't practice ahimsa. But I'm going to sit and I'm going to seek out ways in nature that I see myself or others doing harm. What changes in my behavior curb that and make a more sattva existence in my heart and mind? And so now I have more reflection on how the practice does impact the world, my own internal world and the external world around me. And perhaps then, if I have the discipline to do so, I can sit in quiet meditation on a sutra, having this as something that is going to spark reflection and thought, and the quiet stillness as I sit with a particular teaching. This allows us to dislodge the samskaras deep down that may be a part of this particular teaching, something that needs to be addressed. And you may find that other artistic modalities, you know, in Tantra, we learn that different types of art or engaging, going deeper into a subject is sometimes a way to be one with it. Samadhi, or the ultimate sense of absorption in something. And perhaps art journaling or some other expressive, you know, manner is what will work for you. And there are some that can do this through chanting. They can do this through other types of metaphor. Any one of those things that work for you, every time I'm sitting with the sutras, I am deepening into the marrow of my bones their meaning. And since most of the people that come and listen to this podcast are yoga teachers, I cannot advocate stronger that one of the greatest ways to understand the sutras is to teach them. And I don't mean teach them with the arrogance of, well, I'm so smart, I should teach these to everybody. But teach them with humility, this idea that in teaching, I will have the challenge of questions, of having to articulate, having to make sure someone else can have a fuller understanding. And to do that, I have to know them really well. And you will hit walls. People ask me, you know, questions, and I think, oh my gosh, I don't really know the answer to that. But you can bet I will go home and I will ruminate and I'll think and maybe I'll do a little research. And then I think, well, I wish I had really known the answer in that given moment, but I don't know it now. And the next time it's asked, or the next time I'm with that student, I can expand on that concept. And the dialogues alone keep it fresh and innovative and exciting to dive into the Yoga Sutras. At no time should we be thinking that learning the sutras means take a test at the end of the course and check off all the definitions. I mean, we can start at the most outward level with our intellect. But from that, we kind of go into our instinctual sense of what is right or wrong. In my mind, what do I see that is truth for me? And we work our way in until we feel in harmony with that ultimate knowledge that we are all born with. It's kind of like in our DNA. Last but not least, there's always this concept that you must meet the student where they live. And that means we begin any learning process. You know, now the exposition of yoga will begin. We begin with where someone rests in their past experience, in their heart, in their mind, in their intellect. It's really important that in the early stages of learning the sutras, we begin with the simplest of text, with the simplest definitions, and those that are defined in a way that perhaps a Westerner would understand, or culturally, depending on whatever their background is, what they are open to. And this is why we have some books that are so very popular today. We have The Yamas and Niyamas by Deborah Dell, or we have True Yoga by Jenny Lee. These are beautifully written books that simplify the core teachings and make it very easy for someone today to kind of grasp concepts. And we build on that. Since learning the sutras is not a one-time shot thing, it's something, think of it more as a spiral or an onion that goes deeper and deeper inward as you peel off layers. We can go from there to maybe a more classic interpretation, and maybe from there even a deeper interpretation, something like Light on the Yoga Sutras by BKS Iyengar. And perhaps we can then find a teacher who is much more classical in their approach rather than academic, or vice versa. Maybe you start with someone who ignites your fire with a very spiritual approach, and then later a more academic approach gives you a new view to add to the mix. And as we combine both the history and the teachings to come to our own definition of them. So my hope is that no one will get frustrated by starting too deep, too far in, and find something simple know that that's not, doesn't embody all of what there is to know, but it's a beautiful and inspirational place to start. If you need recommendations, those books I've just mentioned are good, and you can always contact us, and I'll give you some of my favorites. My hope is that whatever path you are on, and however you define yoga for yourself, you understand that without knowing the origin or the true classical teachings, then most of our yoga isn't really uniting heart and mind. It's the whole purpose of yoga is to bring us closer to our spiritual source. So it's impossible to skip this element or this limb of yoga. So stay on the path, you know, learn the Yoga Sutras in whatever way makes a heart knowing bloom within you. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to sharing more conversations with you soon. Namaste.
Thank you for joining us for the Yoga Perspectives podcast. We hope the conversations offered here informs and inspires your practice, helping you to connect with yoga on a deeper level. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. For more information about Heartwood Yoga Institute, check us out at heartwoodyogainstitute.com. We are honored to be a part of your ever-unfolding yoga journey and encourage you to not only live your yoga, but to share the wisdom with others. Namaste.